Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Economics for Rebels, the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Not too long ago, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered. This rebellion continues. This is a podcast dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations. Conversations with and for those who are ready to act on rapid and radical change for people and planet.
Welcome to our podcast. I am your host, Alexandra Kovash, and you are listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. Staying within planetary boundaries means that our consumption patterns must change. This is ever so true when it comes to environmentally highly detrimental activities, such as flying. But today's reasoning goes that if we reduce flying, not only do we give up on enjoyable pursuits as customers, but we also jeopardize the livelihood of those working in the industry. The work that destroys the environment for the sake of short-term profit is often called a batshit job. How can we transform these industries for the sake of ecological sustainability while providing a just transition for those employed in them? Today's guests are Haliki Krainin and Tahir Latif, and we will talk about necessary changes in labor and the just transition to a more sustainable society using the aviation industry as an example. Haliki is a founding member of the Vienna Degrowth Association and a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Münster, where she works on the 1.5 Lifestyles Project, aiming to analyze barriers and enablers of degrowth lifestyles and their public acceptance. She received her PhD, Trade Unions and the Social Ecological Transformation of Work, from the Ecological Economics Institute at the Vienna University of Economics and Business. Tahir is a former aviation group president of the UK trade union PCS and the co-author of A Green New Deal for Gatwick, which called for urgent investment in green jobs and retraining in the regions surrounding the airport. They co-authored a chapter in the book called Degrowth and Strategy, How to Bring About Social Ecological Transformation on the Just Transition in the Aviation Industry. Welcome, Haliki, and welcome, Tahir.
Hi, nice to be here. Thanks very much.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
In the previous episodes, we have covered many topics that concerned work. We talked about the decommodification of labor. We talked about redistribution, the necessity of working time reduction. But mostly we talked about the necessity to scale down consumption that would undoubtedly impact paid work as we now know it. And that is one topic that is absolutely crucial. We so often hear that phasing out coal or banning short-haul flights or slowing fast fashion is impossible due to the resulting loss in jobs, batshit jobs, that is, i.e. jobs that negatively impact the environment or our health, but we are still adamant that we need them. And this seems like a trap. Is it a trap, you think?
Yes, it is a trap. So I think this has come up in also in other podcast episodes that you've done. But the problem is that we've been getting better and better at converting materials and energy into more production and making human labor very productive. So for example, through the use of the computer, which obviously has a lot of rare earth minerals and uses energy and so on, and through the use of more and more technology. So this is what we call the productivity trap, so that in order to have high employment, we need to consume more and more to keep up with production. And of course, we live in 2022, we don't live in the early 20th century, so we have material abundance. And we have enough material wealth so that we don't need to increase the rate of production anymore. And we rather just need a better division of material wealth, not more stuff. We would argue that it's a trap, and we go into that a little bit in our chapter, although we mostly focus on how do we transform away from the current situation. And of course, you already spoke to Steffi Gerold about working time reduction. So you've kind of hit on one of the key policies. And Tahir, feel free to jump in also if you if you want to add anything. But I guess the key point is that production always precedes consumption. So we've kind of focused for the last 40 years, we've been focusing on reducing consumption for sustainability and so on, and especially on the individual level. But production decisions are made before consumption decisions are made, so that firms decide to produce a certain amount and then they will find ways of selling that stuff, right? That's why we have the marketing and advertisement industry and so on. So we can't really discuss sustainable consumption without discussing sustainable production. And when we discuss sustainable production, a lot of that is also about limiting production and thus limiting work. And then the question is, how do we get off this sort of treadmill of production? And clearly a key part of that is, how do we transform work and how do we limit work and reduce work?
I would only add to that, that in terms of it being a trap, of course, it is definitely a trap for workers who can only conceive of being in the jobs that they're in at the moment. And the idea that you could offer them something else isn't really a realistic proposition until you actually make that thing tangible. So until then, they'll be very protective about the jobs that they're in, I would say. And that's kind of key to the issues we're talking about in the chapter about the transformation of work.
Okay, so now we understand the problem, but what is the response of ecological economics to this productivity trap? And how can we transform wage work?
So we already discussed working time reduction, and that's needed as a way to limit our production. Another way to limit production would be to focus on sectors that are less productive, so for example, service sectors and so on. And in general, to move away from sort of praising production above all else, or praising productivism. And already there's various social ecological policies that have been discussed for a long time that exist, which would help us move away from productivism, for example, eco-social taxes, minimum maximum income and consumption corridors. So this is what Professor Doris Fuchs and Elke Pegmaier, Julia Steinberg also focus on. And then, of course, none of these policies or ideas are new. There's been work on this since at least since the mid 1990s. I recently read a paper by John Batty from the mid 1990s focusing on this. Andre Gortz was already writing about this much earlier. Tim Jackson, Peter Victor, and Yorgos Kallis have been kind of tooting this horn for the past 20 years. So the question is rather, how do we get these policies passed? And this comes back to what Tahir said as well, that it's very difficult to move away from this current system where people's sort of material welfare and security is based on full-time work and increasing production and kind of making the treadmill run faster. So the key question is providing people with sort of material security, because otherwise we're not going to get very far in terms of climate action.
Yes, I couldn't say it better than that, really. It's really just about the transition of an economy from the production of things, I think, to more of a caring economy where jobs are actually in sectors like care and health and growing of things and so on, rather than the production of goods. As the polarization between those who have and those who don't have continues to grow, obviously the consumption of those goods is limited to that small amount and just exacerbates the whole cycle. So I think a transformation of that is inevitable at some point because it's completely unsustainable.
For such a transformation, we probably need the trade unions, or I would suspect that we needed the trade unions, but you can correct me if I'm wrong. But trade unions have long had a hugely controversial role in sustainability transitions. On the one hand, what they do is crucial in terms of social sustainability, but we see how in the current system, the protection of workers' rights is now artificially decoupled from the protection of the environment. So obviously trade unions are in no easy position. What do you think? Can they help, or should they help, or will they help?
Well, I think the first thing to say really in response to that is that trade unions have had a controversial history more generally. I think in some ways union history could be seen as a case of peeling away layers to arrive at a more enlightened position, and the current issues around climate are the latest example of that. So in earlier times, when women workers and migrant workers were introduced to the workforce, unions' response was initially quite reactionary, negative, confrontational. And this was understandable to some extent in that they perceived that employers were undercutting their jobs with cheap labour. And from the women and the migrants' perspectives, they needed those jobs. So in a sense, it's an example of the trap that we referred to earlier, with workers compelled into confronting one another rather than the employer who exploits them all equally. And I think the environment is a similar barrier to be overcome by the trade union movement. As in those previous stages, when unions transcended their opposition to female and migrant workers and became instead champions of equality, here they need to achieve that same transcendence and recognise that, as you rightly say, the opposition between jobs and the environment is an artificial one, that we all need to live together on this planet, and that to do so requires more work, more jobs than we currently have. So it's not just a false dichotomy. The environment is actually where the future of work lies. It's a long, slow process, and some elements of the union movement will continue to be reactionary, as we're seeing in some places at the moment. But ever increasing numbers of ordinary members are, in my experience, becoming aware of the transformation in the work that we do that is needed. Haliki, did you want to add to that?
Yes, I think what makes this more difficult than, for example, the question of female workers or even the gay rights movement is that limiting production for the environment, degrowth, you know, what is necessary, kind of goes against the fundamental sort of treadmill system in a way that, for example, women's inclusion in the labour market did not, if anything, that was possibly beneficial, in the same way that companies, obviously, there's a lot of talk about purple washing, but companies can go along with also with gay rights or with the Black Lives Matter movement because it doesn't directly kind of contradict their profit making. But I would suggest that this goes kind of back to Alan Schneiberg and his theory of the treadmill of production. So he says that labor organizations historically were against the environmental movement because they saw the interests of workers as being aligned with more production, you know, and the exploitation of the environment along with business and the state. And of course, that was the case because more production meant full employment for workers and also sort of increasing material security and material consumption, which of course in the post-war era was still more necessary. But I think the question also what Tahir mentioned was that now, of course, we live in a different era and we need trade unions to go against the treadmill system, which has, in a way, it has provided for worker welfare and increasing material consumption and employment and so on. So it is an unnatural thing in some ways for trade unions to do. Sorry, Tahir, I don't know if you agree with this. This might be a bit controversial now. But nevertheless, it's what we're fighting for and what we need trade unions to do. Sorry.
Will trade unions be able to meet these challenges? Because they already have a lot on their plates. I mean, the world is not going towards a state where trade unions are becoming stronger and more supported. So will they be able to meet this demand, you think?
Well, there's a lot of different unions as well. So I think it's difficult to talk about trade unions as a kind of like one group because there's a lot of divergence between them, also depending on which sectors they organize in and so on. So this is basically what we discussed in the chapter as well. So me and Tahir, we suggest, Tahir, correct me if I'm wrong, or if you don't agree. So in general, the social ecological transformation that we need is going to be very, very difficult. And we need a big social movement of many different actors in society. And historically, the actors that have sort of brought emancipation for the biggest numbers of people have been trade unions and workers' movements. Right. So that would kind of, if we look back to history, that would kind of lead us to believing that we also need a big workers' movement for the environment. And that doesn't mean that all trade unions will necessarily take part in that, or that all trade unions are friends of the environmental movement, because of course, or we are even seeing now that, for example, trade unions in Germany, so IG BCE has stood up for fossil fuel industries because the interest of the industry aligns with the interest of their members, in the short term at least, more than environmental movements. So whereas other trade unions, for example, have campaigned against the same fossil fuel industry. So there's a lot of division also in the labor movement. I think it's unfair to single out kind of, I think it's unfair to single out sort of labor unions in a way because they're also not separate from society. And in general, we need much broader societal transformation.
Can I add to that as well? I think the key point that Haliki mentioned there is was the phrase short term, because there is a question given the situation as regards climate change and what that means for what we need to be doing in the future. There is a suggestion of what are actually our interests as workers? What are our long-term interests as workers? If we cling on to those industries, like in the fossil fuel industry or aviation, as we'll come to in a moment, what happens when we can't do those things anymore? You know, where will the jobs be? So we need to start thinking about that now and not just say, well, the immediate interest of our workers is obviously keeping them in the jobs that they're in right at this very moment. We need to actually have a longer term view as well, while we're protecting their jobs in the present day.
Yeah. But I think, as you said, Sandra, sort of workers in general and trade unions also are under a lot of pressure, and there's a lot of different crises going on as well. So inequality is rising, there's like polarization of jobs. There's a huge cost of living crisis in the UK, for example. All of these different crises make it very difficult to look to the long term, because when people's sort of immediate material security is threatened, that is what people also focus on. And I think sometimes it does feel a little bit like also an ecological economics, or kind of in our field where there's a lot of well-meaning and well-paid researchers who have the ability to sort of live in big houses and travel by train. It does seem that we also lack kind of solidarity with people that are affected in their everyday lives. And I think this is also what sort of Oshaya Lelkash said in your podcast with her about having to have social structures that hold people and provide for material security. I think that's the key question, also on how you take people with you. And I think that's a question that we haven't really managed to solve so far. This is basically also what we discuss in the chapter a little bit.
Yeah. I think it's not rocket science, though, to actually both fight for your members' interests in the present day and start working on what's going to happen in the future. I think you can do both those things and not feel that you're betraying your members' interests. But It is true, exactly what you say, that certainly in the UK, we've had austerity politics for the last 10, 12 years, and the cost of living crisis now, the increasing pressure of those things makes it more and more difficult for unions to think about those longer term objectives, and just forces them to actually think in a short term way, I think.
Mm-hmm. Let's now look at the aviation industry, a really good illustration of an industry that could shrink if we wanted to, but of course we don't want it to shrink. And I don't mean ecological economists, but I mean like society as a whole. And most people like flying, even though it is not an absolute necessity. So even though everyone is well aware of the sustainability impacts of this industry, we tend to find reasons why we should not stop. And recently, and this is where our work actually meets, recently with a colleague of mine, we published a paper on criticizing the aviation industry's sustainability strategy from a degrowth point of view. And this criticism was based on something they actually wrote. The industry itself wrote in its strategy that if we all chip in to pay for the developments on technology, this technology only might lead to sustainability. And also, most of the gains they proposed were actually coming from offsetting. And still, with this technology that we don't have the money for, or, well, they want society to chip in, they only promise to halve their emissions by 2050. But at the same time, they say we have to accept that they will actually increase emissions until 2035. And not for one second in that document did they consider moderating their growth model, except for a little mitigation for COVID-19 impacts. And the reasons for that, they claim, is firstly that they are serving connectivity in the globalized world. And secondly, they claim that they provide millions of jobs and they need to keep providing them. And of course, the latter is true. I think with regard to connectivity, we could probably find alternatives. But yes, at the moment, they do provide millions of jobs. Now, let's say that we do take sustainability seriously. What could really happen to those people who lose their jobs in the aviation industry? What is the transition that you envision for these people?
Okay, well, there's quite a lot in that question, so I'll try and do justice to all the various points. So in the first place, I think it's an interesting perspective that most people like flying. I'm not saying that isn't true, but we do need a sense of perspective about who it is that actually does the flying. There's a commonly quoted figure from a UK study that 70% of flights are taken by just 15% of the population, and that 50% don't fly at all in any given year. This is pre-pandemic, of course. Further studies looking at other countries in Europe and North America produce a very similar pattern. Meanwhile, work by the anti-expansion campaign group Stay Grounded shows that just 1% of the world's population is responsible for half of all aviation emissions globally, and 80% of the world's people have never set foot on a plane. So the idea that most people like flying is certainly true for us as we live our day-to-day lives in the West, but inevitably quite a selective interpretation, if you like. I did read your paper on aviation sustainability, and of course the underlying implication is that the industry's business model cannot make the change that we need, even if it wanted to, which it doesn't. Their strategy is entirely disingenuous in that of the three categories of solutions that are on offer, two of them, offsetting and sustainable fuels, are simply red herrings that either do not work or they produce other calamitous effects. Now, I'm no technical expert on these matters, and I direct your listeners to the website for Biofuel Watch as a good place to get some really detailed expert explanation of what that actually means. The third solution is technology. Now, this may or may not be developed, but certainly not within a timescale that meets the climate emergency. And the idea of continued growth till 2035 as the price for later solutions is completely unacceptable in terms of the catastrophe that would help to bring about. Yet, as you said in your paper, the aviation industry seems to be completely blind to this and cannot conceive of anything other than continuing and increasing growth. So in this respect, the industry is an exemplar of capitalism. It represents a hardening of neoliberal ideology into an iron logic that essentially controls people's thinking to the extent that they can see no alternative and have to sacrifice their own humanity. There is some kind of genius in the way the system is set up to produce that outcome. My own working experience at NATS, which is the UK's air traffic control provider, testifies to that. I mean, it's basically a safety organisation that was in the public sector, and its privatisation made it dependent for its financial solvency on the amount of air traffic it can push through the UK airspace system. Now, there are many good workers at NATS trying sincerely to devise ways of reducing emissions, but where public ownership would enable them to look at the whole picture in a privatised context, they're entirely constrained by the overriding imperative to increase traffic growth, and that cannot be compromised under any circumstances. As for the claim that the industry is servicing a demand, well, we know perfectly well this is not the case. Like with roads, if you build more, the more traffic there will be. And so with airports and airspace capacity, if you increase it, that is what generates the demand, not the other way around. If you factor in that the primary use of that extra capacity will come from the top 15% of frequent flyers that I mentioned earlier, will intensify those inequalities even further, then the case for expansion becomes even less compelling. In fact, if you flip that logic on its head and say that the main reductions in flying need to come from that 15%, let's say to the same level as the rest of us, then simple maths tells you that the demand goes down by at least half, and that's without touching the average person or family's annual holiday abroad, which is the thing the industry loves to say that we, as environmental campaigners, are trying to take away. Finally, on the matter of jobs, of course, reducing flying in the current context would reduce the number of jobs, hence the position of many trade unions in the industry is to support expansion to prevent that from happening. But those unions are fighting the same employers right now to protect their members against the threat of efficiencies due to automation and improved processes. So you could say that expansion only saves some jobs until the next round of efficiencies, and all you're really doing is slowing the rate of decline, which is a poor position to be in. But I think the big question is what happens to those workers if we did actively reduce the amount of flying? Well, first, we have to distinguish between jobs that are actually aviation related and those that are ancillary. I mean, simplistically, if you work at a cafe in an airport, you could just as easily work at a cafe in a rail station. And given that a reduction in aviation should be accompanied by an increase in alternatives, then you would be looking for that kind of shift to actually happen. In terms of dedicated aviation workers, there are two options and one long-term objective to consider. The first option is to redeploy workers to other sectors, whether to alternative forms of transport that you're looking to provide or to non-transport sectors. We should use the skills that aviation workers have wherever possible to deploy them to suitable areas without forcing them to do that. And we have to ensure the training is there to do something unrelated if preferred. And this was our approach to the Green New Deal for Gatwick report, which we'll come to shortly. The other option is to utilise the skills, knowledge and experience of aviation workers to support and maybe even accelerate the development of technological solutions, whether that's electric, flight, hydrogen-based or whatever. Those new types of aircraft or new fuels will require different airport configurations and a different approach to airspace. So there's a lot of work to be done to make that come about, and a more labour-intensive approach to the industry up ahead. But, of course, less flying and instead deploying staff to what is effectively R&D activities, that's not really compatible with the economic orthodoxy of the industry. What we have is a timeline where aviation employment sags for a few years and a long-term objective of regrowth if and when those solutions are implemented. And all of that is a challenge to the business model, and it demands that government intervenes to ensure that these developments happen and that the jobs are there to support it. So, Haliki, did you want to add anything on that point?
Thanks, Tahir. I really like what you said, and especially in the jobs front as well, that aviation has been an industry undergoing massive sort of structural change and the shedding of jobs. And it's really one of the most, it's a terrible employer, as well as being really bad for the environment. And in fact, we did another study on aviation workers as part of the FEPS Young Academics Network, where we spoke to different trade union representatives from the aviation sector in different countries in Europe. And it's interesting that aviation has been kind of actually, we have seen a lot of new forms of organizing happen in aviation because it's such a bad employer. So a lot of cross-country sort of working together, different Ryanair employees, for example, working together for better conditions. And our one Austrian representative said actually that he tells his members in, who work for Ryanair in Austria, but they're actually better off getting unemployment benefits because the employment conditions are so poor and so many people are being let go of. To me, this again shows this need to fight all the crises together. And of course, the rail industry is also undergoing privatization and sort of restructuring in Europe, but it's still a much, much better employer than the aviation sector. And in terms of what Tahir said about inequality in who travels and who flies, just kind of draws our attention again to the issue of inequality and how that relates to climate change. Because, of course, we know that inequality in general is very much related to the environmental crisis. And that, again, takes us back to this question of material security and you know, and providing people with the material, social sort of basic needs that they have outside of the paid employment, whether in the aviation sector or elsewhere. So yeah, that's the only way we can kind of face that crisis.
It's really interesting to kind of translate the general thoughts into an example, but I think it's even more exciting when you can translate the example into another example and like start focusing on one particular area. And Tahir, you worked on the document called A Green New Deal for Gatwick. And this document called for urgent investment in green jobs and retraining in the region surrounding the airport. Did it meet any support?
Yes, it did. So I should say the Green New Deal for Gatwick reports, it was less a response to climate change in itself, though it certainly comes from that perspective. It was more about the huge and sudden loss of jobs at the airport in the face of the COVID pandemic Now, it's debatable how much of that job loss was unavoidable in the circumstances and how much was opportunism on the part of the employers involved. I tend to suggest it was more the latter. What isn't debatable, though, is that the situation highlighted just how overly dependent on the airport the local region is for its employment prospects. And I'm sure this applies in many other areas as well. And also what a travesty it is to then just leave those workers to languish in unemployment when there is such a need for them across all sectors of the local economy. So the report was based on a model created by the think tank Greenhouse, and it took local social, geographic and demographic factors into account, worked out that 16,000 jobs could be created in the area around Gatwick in public services that were deficient, such as care, education and local transport, and in climate jobs, the transition to renewable energy, retrofitting homes and so on. It also sought to match the existing skills of aviation workers to as many of those jobs as possible and called, as you said, for retraining to be in place where needed. The report also estimated that the cost of those jobs will be about half of the annual tax break that Gatwick Airport receives from the government every year. In terms of support, so locally, the report generated a lot of interest and support, including among local authorities. It's not hard to see why, because the proposals in it were concrete numbers and costs. And importantly, they were clearly rooted in the needs of local communities, things people could see lacking around them in their everyday lives. It's hard to know actually how far its recommendations are being implemented. For one thing, politicians love to claim, as they did here, that they were doing many of these things anyway. And second, because the airport has, of course, sought to reassert its dominance over the local authority, over the local area, as if there were no alternative. But the window of opportunity remains ajar, and there is local interest in doing something with those recommendations. I'd say, though, that the most significant source of support has been from other areas of the country that see in it a template that they can apply to their own towns and cities and regions. We supported local activists in the production of a report called A Green New Deal for the Leeds City Region, which functions as an alternative employment plan to the proposed expansion of Leeds Bradford Airport. And of course, it doesn't have to be airports. I mean, communities based around nuclear plants, incinerators, fracking sites can use this method to develop alternative plans that decarbonise their local area and benefit their communities. Ultimately, what that means, and I do recognise I'm being extremely simplistic or maybe outright utopian in saying this, but if we imagine every city, town and region has a plan of this type for its own area, linking these up would form a national movement based around a coherent set of demands, geographically and socially diverse, but serving a common cause. I don't know about across Europe, but certainly in the UK, we have a complete vacuum in terms of national leadership, a government that isn't remotely interested in the issues we are talking about here. So we're the ones who have to build that and demand it on a scale that cannot be ignored, from the bottom up, grassroots. And actually, that's a very exciting prospect.
I'd love to also know what workers in the aviation industry thought of that. Are they ready to be retrained, or they'd love to just stay in their jobs as long as possible?
Well, so Sandra, there is no simple answer to that in the sense that it's a mixed situation. You know, that, or even those workers that express a desire to kind of cling to the aviation industry and hope that expansion or regrowth after the pandemic happens, even amongst those, there are different viewpoints. Well, we have to because there's no alternative, through to the other end of the spectrum, which is people who are very enthusiastic about the industry. But what has surprised me is the degree to which workers in aviation are actually prepared for the future and what might happen. One particular group within Stay Grounded, for example, is called Safe Landing, which is a bunch of aviation workers, including pilots, who realise that there may be a limited lifespan on the profession that they have at the moment, and are advocating for planning what the future might look like in a kind of reduced aviation scenario. So there's a whole range of different views about that. And bear in mind, of course, when we were doing the Green New Deal for Gatwick report, it was essentially what to do with workers who had already lost their jobs, who hadn't, you know, we recognised they would have no prospect of re-entering the aviation industry. And actually, what do we do with that incredibly skilled and valuable workforce? Those who are in the industry, of course, are frightened of losing their jobs as well if the employer continues to attack their jobs and wages and terms and conditions. And yet at the same time, they have mixed feelings because they also think that, well, the job I'm in is the job I'm in, and I'm worried about what will happen if I'm not in that job. So it's quite a diverse range of views, I would say, there.
Halike, would you like to add something to that? To the public sphere?
Yeah, sorry. I was just going to say that the Green New Deal for Gatwick is brilliant because it brings together many of these kind of issues that we talk about. And that's the way that we should be facing these crises of employment, of society, of the, you know, environment. And I think this is the difficult part. And this is where we're seeing so little of that in terms of country level politics, and much more of that in terms of sort of local politics. Especially sad in the case of the UK is the extent to which the Labour Party has kind of failed to take up these issues. And today, Yvette Cooper actually even criticised Insulate Britain protesters and so on. And so I would say I'm much more hopeful about local politics myself as well. And of course, as we mentioned, sort of employment itself has been largely ignored as a question for the environment. And it goes much further than just the aviation sector. So of course, the aviation sector, it's pretty clear that this sector needs to grow basically. And there's other sectors that are like that, of course, the coal industry and so on. But there's also, if we take the sort of 1.5 degrees, barrier and the Paris Agreement seriously, that means actually that we need a much larger reduction in many other forms of employment as well. And I think I'm not seeing anything, unfortunately, or I'm not seeing that being discussed in ministries of employment at all. And in fact, I was recently at a meeting with some workers from the Ministry of Employment in Austria, and I asked one of the representatives if they'd read the IPCC report. It had just come out, and I suggested that it probably is quite important for them in the Ministry of Employment. And he said, "Why would that be important for us? We're not the Ministry of Environment, you know." So I think we have a really, really kind of far way to go. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, systems view, not story. Typical.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, many of these sort of structures also reinforce each other. So the full employment, for example, economic growth paradigm, inequality, poverty, climate crisis, all of these kind of crises make each other worse as well. And I think it's very difficult then to see where it is that we can make change, or where we can transform the system, because it just seems like we're kind of, the inertia of the system itself is so large that it is kind of disheartening. And that's again where I think that Tahir's, sorry, I don't know if it actually belongs to Tahir, but that the Green New Deal document itself is really amazing. Like, Green New Deal for Gatwick is amazing because it tries to do that exactly. And then I think localizing these issues is really, really important, because local politics, that's where we can maybe enact change.
To close out this episode, I'm asking both of you the question I ask all my guests. What is your rebellion?
Well, if I go first, I think what I'd like above all is to be able to persuade people that another world is possible. I'm 61 years old, and I was 18 when Thatcher and Reagan came to power and set the world on the course it has been ever since. So my whole adult life has been spent within that neoliberal system. And for anyone younger than me, of course, that is all they've ever known. So my wish is that we recognise that it doesn't have to be that way. You know, the so-called logic and rationality of what we have is not some universal truth or eternal certainty, however much it is presented as such. Most of human history has not been lived under this system, and we need to be clear that we can and must do something else. To save the planet, yes, but also to transform the quality of our lives and the role of work within that better world.
Haliki?
Yeah, thanks. I really like what you said, Tahir. Yeah, my rebellion. Well, so this might sound a bit new agey, but I would go as far as to say that the needed sort of social ecological transformation of our society and economic system, it does not just have to be about the environmental and social crises and the crises of work and so on. For me, it's also more fundamentally about human agency and liberation. So my rebellion would be to rethink for ourselves why we live in certain ways, how we live, and just to kind of liberate ourselves from culture and social structures that don't necessarily add to our welfare. And I think work is just one of those structures. So it's about rethinking how we spend the few hours, the 4,000 weeks, as Oliver Berkman says, on this planet. What is really important? So time with friends and family. What do we do? How do we actualize ourselves? What is it that we want to do? And it's about liberating work as well as liberating us from work to a certain extent. So my rebellion would be to rebel against these sort of cultural and mental structures that keep us not liberated.
So many thanks to Haliki and Tahir, and thanks to all of you for spending time with us.
Our pleasure.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Stay tuned with us for the next episode. Bye, Tahir. Bye, Al-Haliki.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.